Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's lecture is titled, Stripping the Ironclad Word, and features Iranian author Shahryar Mandinapour and translator Sarah Khalili. We begin with an introduction by Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University.
I'm very excited about our talk today because we have the rare privilege of having both a renowned novelist and his translator here to talk to us about their process. This is the first and the last instance of that in the seminar, and I think it'll be really great to hear about their process and the way that they work together. I'm going to introduce the translator first, since this is the translation seminar. We have Sarah Khalili, who's an editor and translator of contemporary Iranian literature. Her most recent translations include Censoring an Iranian Love Story, I Will Greet the Sun Again, Selected Poems of Farouk Farrokhzad, and various short stories in Strange Times, My Dear, the Penn Anthology of Contemporary Iranian Literature. She received the 2010 Penn Translation Fund Award for her translation of Seasons of Purgatory, a selection of short stories by Mandinapour, our author who's here today. And her translations of Mandinapour's works have appeared in the Literary Review, the Kenyon Review, Virginia Quarterly Review, and Words Without Borders. Shahryar Mandinapour is regarded as one of the most accomplished writers of contemporary Iranian literature. He's won numerous awards for his novels, short stories, and nonfiction in Iran. Mandinapour is the author of 9 volumes of fiction, 1 nonfiction book. His collections of short stories include The Eighth Day of Earth, Violent Orient, Midday Moon, Mummy and Honey, Shadows of the Cave, and Ultramarine Blue. He's the author of the 2-volume novel, The Courage of Love. And from 1999 until 2007, he was editor-in-chief of Asre Panjshanbe, which apparently means Thursday evening, a monthly literary journal published in Shiraz. Censoring an Iranian Love Story is his first novel to appear in English. There was a great review of this novel in The New Yorker by James Wood, where he mentions the fact that this is a novel that that depends on translation for its very existence. It wasn't possible to publish this novel in Iran, so what we have here in English is its only published manifestation. So anyway, welcome to BU, we look forward to hear your talk.
Thank you all. Actually, today is Sorrow's Day, I think. There were many times that I had interviews, and patiently she was sitting there for hours and hours and helped me to speak in English. But today is, I think, it is her day, and I have just talked a little bit. As a preface, I would like to say how much a word could be worth for a writer. A writer as, for instance, maybe an Eastern writer, that some of them are not like an employee. That early morning they wake up and at the, just for instance at 9 o'clock sitting at the table and start writing. In my country it is something else, I think so. Good or bad. I remember that I was at my army service at the front line. There was a long war between Iran and Iraq. And we were in front line. And the days that there wasn't any attack or something like it, I used to sit in my shelter. And because I didn't have any job to do, and I was so nervous and I was so sad about this absurd war, I tried to write stories. Not a war story, because when an event should be settled in the mind of a writer for years, 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 and then he can write it well. I was writing a love story, what we didn't have there. And when I was riding, I heard the firing of the mortars of Iraqians or artillery of Iraqis. I heard the sound of firing. And it took about 3 seconds that the mortar shell came over our shelters. If the mortar shell goes somewhere else, not on the roof of my shelter, for instance, it was okay. But if came to my the roof of my shelter, me or other soldier died. So I was riding, and I was thinking about a word, a good word, to choose the precise word or artistic word for this sentence. And I heard the firing, the sound of firing. And I had just 3 seconds to choose a word, to choose the beautiful, best word, and go on my stories. It is something, this word was something between my life and my death. At that moment, at that short moment, I felt the word, the value of the words. A word could be the life or the death of a rider. It was a good lesson for me, how to use words, even if I wouldn't be at the war, or even what would be in a free country. I wish that I have this feeling even in the United States. Secondly, I come from a country that riding, free riding, is a crime for the regime. And you could be the target of assassination, as I was once. So it gives another meaning to my riding. And let's move to translation. I would like to have a quote from Heidegger. He said, "A broken hammer is more hammer than a good hammer." Think about this one. Because the broken hammer make a sort of deconstruction of the meaning of the hammer. And you realize everything that it has. I think translation would be something like it. Not a broken prose, but a translation deconstruct and reconstruct the prose, the poem from one language to other language. Okay, this is my talk, and here we go.
Do you want to say a little bit about the whole concept of writing the book, knowing that it's not going to be published in Farsi and that it would only appear in English, that you were writing for the first time a work that was destined only for translation? Did that make a difference in how you wrote the book?
I don't think that when I was writing this book, I was just thinking about Western audience or Western readers. The point is that I'm coming from a country that, because of many invasions, because of many attacks, Iskander, Greece, then Arabs, then Mughals, then Turks, then Afghans. And because in our history, there were many governments, there were many regimes in Iran, Iranian people don't use and prefer not to leave any evidence or any documents about their life in their houses. In every time, there is a possibility that secret police storm at their houses and got every evidence that they have, every document. So they are prefer not to leave any evidence from their life or their about their secrets in their houses. They destroyed them. On the other hand, the government as well, they used to not to make a documentary about what they did and what they are going to do. There is no evidences or documents. So right now, maybe my generation knows that what happened in Iran and what censor do. It is how censor massacre the creativity of writers or artists. Maybe my generation knew it and knows it. But what about the other generation? There wouldn't any evidence, there wouldn't be any document. And they couldn't feel and they couldn't understand what happened to us. So this book maybe would be for new generation of Iranians as well. So I didn't write it just for Western reader.
I remember a couple of years ago, Shahriyar wrote an essay. Our publisher had asked him to write it. It was going to be part of the promotion of the book. And he wrote an essay about the first time that he discovered he could write. He was in fourth grade, and he had written a composition. And he wrote about that composition, his teacher's reaction to it, and it was very short, straightforward, no fuss. I translated it. We had very little time. I sent it off to the publisher, and a couple of hours later, Shahriyar called me, and in his very, very quiet, polite, diplomatic way, he told me that I'd made a mistake in translating the dialogue he had had with his teacher. Me being a perfectionist, my heart dropped. I grabbed the essay. I went through it sentence by sentence with him on the phone. You wrote this, and I translated that. Lengthy defense. He listened to me very patiently. And then he paused, and he said, "But Sarah, my teacher was a man, not a woman." I was floored. It was too late to correct the mistake. But here's what's interesting. In Farsi, the third person singular pronoun, u, is genderless. It doesn't indicate he or she, it just is. Could be for either gender. Throughout the throughout that segment of the story, Shahriyar had never named his teacher, nor had he given any description of the teacher that would tell the average reader whether the teacher is a man or a woman. On the other hand, growing up, I had always had women as grade school teachers. I'd never had a man teacher. And suddenly I realized, my God, in my mind, subconsciously, a grade school teacher is a woman. Where for boys, it was always a man teacher. And it was a huge lesson to me that as a translator, to a huge degree, I really have to separate my identity from myself as a translator. I really have to put my own life experiences aside, because just because my teacher was a woman, and in my mind, a grade school teacher is a woman, it doesn't mean his is. It was a very, very big lesson. Unfortunately, it was too late to correct the mistake. We let it go, but a very valuable lesson learned, both about how the translator must separate from herself, and also about the depth and the simplicity of the ambiguities in languages, and all languages are ambiguous. I think that's the last time I ever made that mistake. But in general, I don't believe in free translation, but nor do I believe in literal translation in the academic sense. I believe there's that happy utopia where the twain shall meet. And in that utopia, I think I am and I'm not. I must exist only as a reflection of Shahriyar. I have no voice of my own, and I must leave absolutely no footprints behind. And my loyalty translator to writer isn't to what Shahryar writes. It isn't to the words he writes. It's to the intent with which he's writing them. It's not the word itself, but it is the how he's writing it and the why he's writing it. I think it's only then that I can do an accurate reflection of what he's saying, as opposed to just seeing the word for what it is. I think when I find that one single word, the perfect equivalent, that is as pure, as simple, of the same scent, sound, and nuance, with the same implications and connotations that he had intended, if I find that one word, then it will fuse as well with the rest as his do. And I think it is only then that the translation will become effortless. Otherwise, it will be a constant struggle. Now, generally speaking, I think Shahryar and I see pretty much eye to eye in terms of what translation is and the entire concept and approach to translation. But there's one dialogue we've had on several occasions, and I don't think we've ever come to a decision on that, is, am I translating or am I rewriting? And in fact, what is the difference between these two? I don't know the answer. I always think I'm translating. He tells me I'm rewriting. I don't know. But for any of you who's hoping to translate or is translating, think about it next time you're translating. It's a very interesting concept.
I think it is said that translation is like a lady. If it would be beautiful, most likely it wouldn't be faithful. And it would be faithful, most likely it wouldn't be beautiful. I don't believe in it. I believe in rewriting the text. We had a good example for it from Farsi to English language. It is the translation of Omar Khayyam's poems. An English man named Fitzgerald rewrite his poem from Farsi to English language, and it was so successful. And she did it. She gave me a beautiful, faithful translation.
You're a very nice diplomat. But now, talking about censoring an Iranian love story and the whole process of translating it, just conceptually first, and then as Keith had requested, we'll get into the nitty-gritties of the translation. But I think the best way to describe our approach to the book can be summarized by a quote by Anthony Burgess, who said, "Translation is not just a matter of words. It is a matter of making an entire culture comprehensible." And that's what we had to do. The book was so seeped in Iranian culture and tradition that we really had to make it palatable for the Western reader. At the same time, Shahryar was very insistent, and so was I, that the book must retain and keep its foreignness and its Iranianness.
I think that the languages have a sort of dialogue. There is a dialogue between languages in the world. It depends on which one has the dominate or which one is weaker than the other one. For instance, in Farsi language, a lot of decades before ago, we didn't have a word or a qual word for process, because at that time we were not industrial country. Process of this word came from the process of making a good or something. It is an industrial word. And we made a cool word for it. But right now, TV, radio, many words from English, many words from Arabic language came to Iranian language, in Persian language. They are dealing. There is a dialogue. So why not that when a word couldn't be translated in the other language, okay, let's export it to that language. It takes time that the audiences or reader get familiar with this word. But I'm sure that it will work. Sora has some examples for it. And,
Now, one thing I made sure to avoid is anglicizing or Americanizing any of the text. We also intentionally avoided all American and English colloquialisms, at least to the degree possible. And we decided in cases where we could not find the perfect equivalent to a Farsi word, to leave it in Farsi, in the text, and then to somehow weave an explanation into the narrative. The question was when to do this, how to do it, and why should we do it? But before we even get to that, the question is, can everything be translated? With a bit of a pause, I will say yes, everything can be translated somehow. But will that translation say what you want it to say, how you want to say it, and in as many words as you need to say it in? The answer is no, not always. And those are the cases where we decided to keep certain things in Farsi. One of the best examples is an old Farsi word, khanje. Khanje means lustful groans during intercourse. Now, I agonized for days trying to find one word, and it had to be one word to fit the structure of the narrative. I couldn't use three words to say it. It had to be one single word. I couldn't find it. And I kept going back to him and asking him again to explain the word to me in greater depth, but lo and behold, no single one word in the English language means all of that. Now, I will read the segment to you, and you'll understand why it had to be just one word and why we decided to keep it in Farsi. In this segment of the book, the narrator is writing a story in which a couple are making love. But fearing censorship, he can't actually depict the scene. He has to somehow hint by words to the reader so that the reader will draw the conclusion himself that the couple the writer is writing about is actually making love. This is what Shahryar writes. I suddenly remembered a word that I had read in old texts of Farsi literature, khanje. That was it, the key to my problem. It was a word that centuries ago had become obsolete. Its meaning, lustful groans during sexual intercourse. From a literary perspective, the aggressive sound of kh that in continuation of its intonation couples with the mysterious sound of j was exactly what I wanted. I wrote of the man's stream of consciousness during their lovemaking. Complicated sentences, a labyrinth of associations and recollections. And finally I wrote khanje. It worked perfectly. But it had to be a word, and the sound had to be right. The best way to do it was to keep it in Farsi. In another instance, where we ran into a similar problem, it had to do with a container that looks exactly like a watering can, but it is not used to water flowers, and for its function, it has no name in the English language. I see a smile back there. The word for it is oftabe. And here, Shahryar used humor to weave in an explanation. This segment, the story is about a cleric who hosted a popular TV show. The man had suddenly disappeared, and people were terribly curious to find out what had happened to their kind cleric. And as a matter of fact, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is a real story. It's a factual story. Then rumor about the oftabe spread throughout the country. Now, the Western reader will ask me what oftabe means. Oftabe is the Farsi word for one of the world's most indispensable objects. This instrument is very similar to the watering can Western ladies use to water their gardens. And we Muslims
use it to wash the flowers of our body after relieving ourselves, which, in my opinion, is a more sanitary process than the tissuey Western method. In any case, long after the disappearance of the kind cleric, rumors spread that the gentleman, unbeknownst to his good wife, had perpetrated the taking of a second wife. When his first wife found out, to exact revenge, she filled his oftabe with sulfuric acid. Now here again, even before I went digging to find one word for oftabe, Shahryar had already decided he wants to keep it in Farsi. Why was that?
As for instance, the word samovar, it comes from Russia to mm-hmm. Iran, and then it came to Europe and even in America, I think so. So, as an Iranian, I'm sorry that you couldn't...
It's an important thing, yeah.
I don't think so. But I prefer that we expert mm-hmm. whether thing to Western language or Western countries, but
it worked. It worked. Now, one of the elements in the narrative that went a long way in keeping that Iranianness that we wanted were the similes that he had used throughout the narrative. And when I first read them, I thought, my God, these must not be changed. They work so well that they're not similes or descriptives that in the English language one would necessarily use, but they were just so vivid that I translated them literally. And I'll just read one sentence. I think it'll give you a nice idea of what I mean. Here, the narrator in the book is describing an old hag of a woman. Like a wolf, not a young wolf, but an old one, with breasts that resemble two sheepskin sacks, an old hump on her back, her face as wrinkled as an Indian walnut, her mouth as wide as a grave. Perfect image of an old hag of a woman. So in this sense, I found the Farsi language to be just so adaptable to translation that you really just flow through it. When it came to adjectives and these sorts of similes, it flowed so much easier than I ever imagined it would. But talking about images, one thing we learned in the process of translating this book was that the image that words conjure up in translation are completely different than the image they have in the original language. In various places, I ran into issues with these images. For example, in 13th century Iran, the name used for lawmen or policemen was shahneh. The equivalent, the accurate equivalent in English is constable. Shahryar uses the word in several scenes where the ghost of the poet who died 700 years ago is drinking wine and several shahnehs arrest him. Every time I typed the word constable, I kept getting these images of old foggy London, British bobbies, and Sherlock Holmes. Not a saber-wielding shahneh from 13th century Iran. So I went back to him. I said, look, constable, it's just not going to work. And we decided to keep shahneh as shahneh and far away from foggy London. This was another reason to just retain the original. Now, the exact opposite of this was true with a different character in the book. It's the phantom of an assassin from the 11th century, and he's a member of the Order of Assassins. The phantom is in relentless pursuit of Dara, the main character of the book, with the intention of slashing his jugular with a dagger. He's a mysterious, dangerous, ominous character. Now, bear in mind, the word assassin is derived from the Arabic word hashashin. Shahryar had asked me to keep hashashin and not translate it into assassin. Now, listen to the words and see what image pops into your mind. The image of the Hashoshin phantom clad in a black burnous, so much more sinister than the ghost of the assassin wearing a black cape. Very different. So we decided here to keep the Hashoshin, but in order for me not to repeat it too many times throughout the text and for it to lose its luster, I alternated between assassin and Hashoshin depending on the sentence and the structure of the sentence and how it would actually sound. This, again, was another aspect of why keep something in a foreign language. It becomes a question of, is it culture? Is it sound? Is it image? To me, it was image. I don't know what it was for you.
Both of them, maybe. I insist on Hashoshin because the use of the repeating of the sound she in it, although in Assassin we have seen, but she is something else in this world. And indirectly, implicitly, Hashoshin refer to hashish. And it is a custom on that era in Iran, because that assassins, when they are going to a mission, they use hashish. And it makes them a sort of unconscious. And it helps them to kill and get killed. So I insist in this world, but we found out that maybe it doesn't work. And as I trust her, as a good translator, I give up. But there are something that, for instance, I can say, I have an essay on an Iranian paintist, and for this essay I used a title, Nefrin-e-Khat. Nefrin-e-Khat. Khat in Farsi has two meanings: a script, writing, and line in painting. And I use this title to have both of these meanings in a title. Mm-hmm. But in English language, we couldn't have both of them together. Or another example is the title of my novel, Dele Deldadegi. In Farsi, it means the courage of falling in love or being a lover. And then the other meaning is to have the heart of a heart of being a lover. There are two meanings. Mm-hmm. In English, we have to get just one of them. We couldn't translate this expression in this title in English language.
But on that subject, talking about titles and words and double meanings, and also related to the whole image issue, is there were times that the image Shahryar wanted to convey was one that our editor wanted to avoid. In the book, Shahryar insisted on using the term Hezbollah when referring to the Islamic political party. In translation, it is translated as the party of God. Shahryar was adamant that I should use Hezbollah. Our editor was adamant that I should use the party of God. And I cannot tell you how many times I went back in that text and changed one for the other and thanked the lords of Microsoft for find replace. But before I explain our editor's point of view, I want to hear why Shahryar insisted on Hezbollah.
Yeah. I insist in this word because Hezbollah is not just a phenomenon in Lebanon. I would like to keep this word as Hezbollah because Hezbollah is a phenomenon that it has started in Iran after Islamic Revolution in Iran. When it was started, when this stream get growth and spread in Iran, there wasn't any Hezbollah in Lebanon or even in Afghanistan or even in Africa. It is like a plague spread all over the world. And I would like that Western reader faith a question. What does it mean? Hezbollah? Is it Lebanese in Iran? Face this question, and then he or she will find or realize that it is something else. And then maybe he could understand, he or she could understand that this plague, this disaster came from my country. This is what I try to get because of his book. Yeah.
Now, our editor, the reason she was so adamant that we should not use Hezbollah, she was worried that the name Hezbollah will immediately draw the reader's mind to what they see every night on the news, that the image that they saw on the news, the suicide bombers, assassinations, the war that was raging. And her argument was, when the reader, in the very first page of the book, comes across the word Hezbollah, it'll be a huge turnoff. It will immediately remind them of the horrors of the evening news. They'll put the book down and never read it again. The battle went on throughout the entire process of editing. We would occasionally revisit it. Eventually, unfortunately, I have to say it's a battle she won. But another battle that was, again, a lengthy one, was with Shahryar's style in narrative. Shahryar generally plays with language, plays with sequence and time. And in this book, although not as much as his other work, there were segments of the book where he played with tenses. He would shift between two tenses. And our editor kept saying, you can't do this. You can't go from the past to the present or to the future. It won't work in translation. It won't be readable. It'll be confusing to the reader. And that was another issue. Personally, I think it worked perfectly fine in English. It just would have... it just requires a more sophisticated reader not to get confused. And I think it would have been fine, but... Again, I think as Keith and I were discussing before, a lot about editing books and books goes back to marketing, I think. But now moving on to the nitty-gritty aspects of the translation, let's very quickly just talk about names. To the extent that was necessary, we translated only those names that had very weighty meanings. Others we just left as is. With let's talk about streets and locations. I'll just read you a sentence. It'll become quite clear why we translated names in this case. Hundreds of cars are log-jammed in Revolution Circle, and anxious drivers blow their horns because police have blocked all traffic to Liberty Street, where students are gathered in political protest. Here, Liberty Street and Revolution Circle served a purpose within the narrative. But there were other streets and roads mentioned in the story where the names didn't necessarily have an effect. So those we left as is. We did the same with the names of characters. We left Tom, Dick, and Harry alone, didn't bother translating those. But there were a few names that Shahryar had very carefully composed intentionally with implied meaning to them. These we had to, well, I had to somehow translate and make work. In some cases, it worked very well. In other cases, not so well. A happy case is when we were dealing with Mr. Kingslave, who after the revolution changed his name to Mr. Pius. Very straightforward, worked perfectly well, no confusion. But when it came to tackling the name of the great romantic poet who after the revolution had fallen on hard times and was peddling his books on the street, that was a whole different ballgame. Shahryar had given him the initials N.V. and the last name Sharab, which means wine. The name N.V. Sharab, when read phonetically in Farsi, is Nun Vasharab, Non Vasharab, which means bread and wine. And here he was cleverly referring to the book by Ignazio Silon. Now, how was I going to translate the initials N.V. Wine to some name in English that could be read as bread and wine. I mean, it just was not going to happen. I went back and forth. Finally, I called him. I said, look, this one, I just don't know what to do with it. And we decided to just leave it as Mr. N.V. Wine. And the first time I typed it, my jaw dropped. There it was, smack in front of me. Now, don't read it with the initials N.V. Wine, but read it phonetically, Mr. N.V. Wine. How appropriate a name for a washed-out poet in a society where alcohol is banned. I got lucky this time. There were other cases where I was not so lucky. There's a character in the book. He is a crude lech of a man, a lounge lizard type. His name is Essie Estefrog. It's a crude nickname. Essie is short for Esmail, like Pete for Peter, and Estefrog means vomit. This is a very, very crude nickname. Now, I had to come up with an equivalent for Essie Estefrog that would be as vulgar, as gross as this, because nowhere in the narrative does Shahryar give any description of this man that would let the reader know of what type of a personality he is. The only indication is the guy's name. There's nothing else that would let you understand that this is like a scruffy, crude, tacky kind of guy. It's only his name. Now, how to come up with the name? I said, okay, Essie what? Essie vomit? Doesn't quite work. I made a list of all the words that mean vomit. What was the list? I had it here. Barf, puke, wretch, heave, nothing worked. I put it aside, totally frustrated. Several days later, I was scrolling through an urban dictionary on the internet, and up popped upchuck. How deliciously vulgar. And I looked at, I will spare you the definition, but it was more disgusting than I could have dreamt of. I called him and I announced the birth of Upchuck Essie, and it just worked. This was one of our more difficult names to deal with. Now, easier than dealing with names were idioms, proverbs, expressions. For the most part, they turned out a lot easier than I thought. Some of them have very near equivalents in English. For example, in Farsi, we say he wouldn't hurt an ant. In English, you say he wouldn't hurt a fly. Or we say presume it unseen. You say turn a blind eye. In Farsi, we say let's wet our lips. You say wet the palate. So these that had very, very close equivalents, we kept the English, the American version of it. There was really no need to translate. Then there were those that don't have equivalents in the English language, but they are so straightforward that even in literal translation, they make sense with no real need to explain them. I'll give you an example. Here's one character warning the other one not to naively trust someone. He says, I'm warning you, don't go down the well with his rotten rope. Self-explanatory, no need for adding anything. There were those that made sense but needed a little bit of a hint. When someone makes a dash for it, we say, he had two legs, he borrowed two more and ran. In this scene, Dara's being pursued by the Hashashin Phantom. Dara sees the glint of hatred for his own and the other's existence in the phantom's eyes, and he hears the wail of the dagger that rises to his murder. In such horrifying circumstances, anyone else would have frozen in place for the dagger to slash through his jugular. But the quick thinking that comes from years of being a political activist and the hundreds of action movies he has seen save Dara. He leaps back, and then, conforming to an Iranian proverb, he has two legs, he borrows two more, and runs. But the phantom, as if he too has borrowed two additional legs, chases him. We could use it, but we just added, well, he added, conforming to an Iranian proverb. Again, we didn't need to meddle with these so much. The one that we fought about for the longest time, it's I still have some issues with it, but I'll explain. It's the expression to my ball or to my right ball, which I'm sure means nothing to you, except for the gentleman in the back, both of whom speak Farsi. Dara is still being chased by the Hashashin phantom. Dara decides not to go out in the dark of night and not to frequent secluded areas in the light of day, and as of tomorrow, to leave his house only when he has made sure the phantom is nowhere nearby. But times will come when he, despite all caution, will be caught off guard by the Hashashin phantom and he will escape. Until at last, defeated and worn by the pursuits and escapes, he will whisper, "You want to kill me? Go ahead, kill me, to my right ball." Transferring anger and frustration to one's testicles is an Iranian expression that basically translates into, "I don't give a f-." This manner of capitulating and no longer caring happens not only to fictional characters, but most likely to everyone in real life too. At some point, one finally transfers fear to an anatomical organ, which would vary depending on your culture, and then together with that anatomical organ, one goes prancing down the street. Okay, fine, but the problem for me was, this was the second time this appeared in the book. The first time was 100 pages earlier and in the middle of a dialogue. And I kept arguing with Shahryar, "Shahryar, you can't leave it there with no explanation. It is completely incomprehensible. It's only 100 pages later that you're giving an explanation of what this means." Shahryar would have none of it. And all he would say in his very calm voice is, "Sarah, trust the reader." Now, do you want to explain that?
I trust a kind of reader who has lived literature and perceived literature, a kind of reader that many, many novels, many poems he has read. Positively, I trust this kind of reader. I believe in Roland Barthes' theory about the death of the other. He says, the death of the other is the birth of the reader. Based on this story, when a reader got a text, each case text, literature, even the menu of a restaurant, he has a sort of talent in language that it comes from his hair or his language, and he has a sort of talent to make another meaning to the text that it couldn't be in the mind of the writer. It means that the reader is free to get another interpretation or to add another meaning to the text or to the story. I believe in it. And the way that I'm writing, try to open, to leave some open windows in my text, in my prose, for the reader. Help him to kill me as a writer. Writer shouldn't be like a dictator over the text and force the reader, just read what I write, and just get what I meant. It's not a modern writing. It was omniscient writing. Maybe Tolstoy, I loved him, I adore him as a great, great writer. But he is just like a god over piece of War and Peace, yeah, sitting there and said, just read. And just get what I meant. In modern literature, no, I don't believe it. And it helps the other as well. I write a story with some meaning. If I have written a good story, fortunately it have two or three layers under the surface of the prose. But if the story let the reader to participate in the text, to participate, to create another meaning, another implicity from the text. It makes the text more huge, it makes the text pure and more rich. And the participating of the reader in the text, it helps him and it helps the text that there would be a sort of feeling between reader and the text that the other is deaf. Because of it, Roland Barthes emphasizes in it that the other is deaf. There is just reader and just the text, just the book. They are alone together. And as you know, Roland Barthes, he was a French critic and philosopher. His ideas from another French philosopher named Jacques Derrida, and the construction, the technique of the construction in the reading. Yeah, the reader could deconstruct or reconstruct the text and make another text in her mind or his mind. I love it. If I could write like it, I will stay in this way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Iranian author Shahryar Mandinapour and translator Sarah Khalili. Tonight's lecture was titled Stripping the Ironclad Word and was presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. Introducing tonight's speakers was Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.